Sheila Stiefel, I am. Stiefel is Austrian for Wellington boot. And I did decide originally that I'd change my name to Sheila Wellington hyphen boot with an E. But I decided that if I did, I'd get stuck with comedy. So I didn't. This is kind of like Desert Island Discs without the desert, the island, or the discs, or Sue Lawley. But it's all about me, which is lovely. And you're going to have to listen, which is lovelier. I thought I might as well begin at the beginning. I was an absolutely ghastly little girl. You know the sort of little girls who are going to grow into actresses. And I had all the signs. I was showy-offy and, you know, slightest opportunity, I'd take people's walks off. I'd walk behind them. My mother encouraged me. So, well, she did the same now, I think about it. Anyway, there you are. And I was taken to old dancing class at the age of three. I've actually got certificates at home saying, second prize, try to point a little harder. I didn't realise they were actually sending me up because they used to go, Sheila, use your face. Use your face. Now, I've been accused of mugging. It's not. It's deep acting. The fact that I've got a face that moves around a lot and I can't help it is, you know, just life. Anyway, I can remember doing it at school. There was a concert and I decided I'd do an opera singer. And I did, in those days, there was an artiste called Madame Tetrazzini. And I did Madame Tetrascreamy. I thought I was ever so good. I got my first laughs ever. I thought, that's for me. I got to university. Don't ask me how. I really have absolutely no idea. But I did a BA Fine Arts. I started and found the Drama Society. And that was much, much more fun. I was nagging my parents. I used to say, I want to go to London and the Royal Academy and be a star. That's what I used to say, in one sentence, always. And I was actually being pursued by a rather virile football player. I'm sitting at some ringside, rather, and he said to me, he was trying to get his hand down my blouse. And I was saying, I'm really unhappy. I want to go to England and be a star, rather. And he said, well, relax, relax. Don't worry about it. And his hand was getting clear. And I said, no, I really am. What do you think? What do you think? And he was getting absolutely nowhere. And eventually he said, look, well, why don't you go? So I went home and said, I want to go. I want to go. I had a nosebleed. My mother said to my father, why are you stopping her? My father said, what? Me? I don't care if she goes. My mother said, I'd be pleased if she goes. So I was allowed to, but they made a condition. They said I had to earn my own fare. So I found a job in the local paper, and it was to be a receptionist for a dental practice. He just started up, and he couldn't afford a real nurse. And so he had a good suite of rooms, and he dressed me up in this nurse. I loved it, nurse's uniform. Yeah. And he had very few patients. He had an appointment book, and more interesting, he had dental plaster and a lot of nice little gleamy instruments. And when he wasn't around, you could actually make this plaster up and you could chisel it into faces and things. It was great. So I used to do that a lot. And I used to have worry when the odd person did come in and he opened his book up. I'd open his appointment book. It was empty. And so I used to fill in names so it looked better. And then, of course, I forgot to put down which were the invented names and which were the real people. And this poor soul used to sit around for hours waiting for people who just didn't turn up. Anyway, I earned my fare, came over here, went to RADA, auditioned, failed. And I looked around and Webber Douglas School was auditioning at the time. So I rushed off, spent, 2 years there, got some good parts. Final term, when they ask all the agents to come and see how you, you know, and give you jobs and that, I got chicken pox. I did, and I remember lying in bed in a hospital with kids in the ward where chicken pox happens. And I can remember a couple of young students, young doctors, coming round to look at my chest. And I couldn't understand why they didn't look at the kids' chest. We were all the same spotty people. Then I got lucky, actually. I got to understudy at the Old Vic. They did a production of The Tempest, Purcell's The Tempest, music and things in amongst the acting. And I was understudying three people, Ariel and two characters that were kind of written in by Purcell or Daz or whoever. So when I rehearsed as an understudy, I had to talk to myself an awful lot, which didn't bother me a bit. Anyway, I knitted a lot of sweaters, which is what understudies did in those days. That's before computers came along. So I made a lot of sweaters for people. And I loved the music. I must say that the music was wonderful. But watching the production, there was a tenor. Oh, he was one of the gods. And he, indeed, the tenor, came down on a cloud that swung quite a lot. Like. And he'd come down and he'd get off his cloud. And he was wonderful. He was short and squat and very tenorish with red hair. Well, they'd given him a very red wig, rather like the jack of whatever it is on card, you know, with curls going up the sides. And he had a pale blue, stiff, sort of tutu-ish miniskirt and a tunic, white tights, gold sandals that wound up his legs. And he'd come down and sing this wonderful aria. And the thing was that he kept time with his big toe. Now, there was nothing you could watch but that toe. He sang like a dream, and that toe was riveting. The rest was a total waste of time. The other thing was that Ariel was played by a rather slim, pretty actress, but the one who sang the Ariel songs was a bigger girl. And so what would happen is Ariel would say her lines, and she'd slip behind a rock, polystyrene rock, and out would come the big one, dressed identically, sing the song, and then she'd hop back, and then the play would continue. Now, out of that, actually, I got my next job, which was very thrillingly, I thought. It was a play with Donald Wolford, big Donald Wolford. And he was playing the lead, and the play was written by Cecil Beaton. And he was going to design the costumes. Well, we got to rehearsals, handed out the scripts, and we read through it, and Donald Wolfit was a bit dismissive about it. He did a lot of, huh, and hmm. Well, the next day when we started to rehearse, he walked in with some rewrites. He said, I've written what I think considers a better scene here. And this went on all the time. And Cecil Beaton would take the rewrites and go home and rewrite the rewrites and then come back and say, I think this is my play and I would like it to be done. And I can remember Wolfit standing up and reading it so with such disdain and then throwing it in the air, saying, I can't do this stuff. This is rubbish. This is not good. And we were all sent off for coffee or lunch or for the day while they had meetings and things. But I say it was very hairy, but in fact, I knew that it was going to be okay because I had a costume designed specially for me by Cecil Beaton. And so I went to Bowman's, I think it was, went upstairs, and there the great man was, and he was leaning against the wall of a cubicle, and he had his hat tipped to one side, and he had his jacket over his shoulders, and he had a long cigarette holder, and he was leaning back. And there on a chair, sort of a pile of sketches of costumes. And there on the top said Sheila. There was a drawing. And it was me. And he said, clothes off. And I stood there in my petticoat. And he said, clothes off. And looked to the heavens. And I stood there in my bra and pants. And he said, take that top bit off. So I did. And prayed he didn't want the other one off. And he looked around and he said, yellow. And a skivvy got down this roll of yellow voile and tore off bits. And he said, bit more. And he wrapped it round my middle, like a sari, round and round and round. And then he tied it off with a piece of string or cotton or tape or something. And he said, yes, somewhere around the middle. Out came a cummerbund that was about 2 inches thick and sort of ridged like a pumpkin. And it was orange, but glittery. And they put it round my middle, and I can't tell you what I looked like. Yes, fine, he said. Head, and they took a couple of feathers out of a jar and held it against the back of my head, and he said, fine. And he went away. And I was almost in tears. I thought, this is awful. So that was that job. I'm not a filmic person. I wish I was, but I'm not. There you go. But I did get a wonderful opportunity. My agent phoned me and said, go to Paris, see about a film. They're doing Tropic of Cancer by Henry Miller. Now, we all know Tropic... Come on, you all know Tropic of Cancer. I know you do. When you were kids, you looked in and everybody had brown paper covers and we looked up the dirty bits. I know you can't fool me. Anyway, I went to see the director. And he said to me, can you do a European accent? Anywhere will do. Well, quite good at anywhere will do. So I did that. Yes, he said, that's fine. He said, can you dance? And I said, yes. And he said, can you show me? And I thought, yeah, okay. I stood up and I did a bit of a jiggle. And he said, no. He said, just hang on to, when you use the back of that chair. And I thought, oh, she's a bit drunk, is she? I thought, she's in a bar. I see, in a bar, a bit drunk, dancing. So I went, da-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee, jiggled about a bit, and he said, no, B-A-R-R-E, bar. She's in a bar. I thought, oh, yes, ballet. So I did a few pliés. Now, pliés are not good for me, you know, but nonetheless, did the, oh, and the arms going, and he said, that's fine. He said, oh, and by the way, can you dance on point? Because she's got to dance on point. You see, this is a dream sequence, and she has to dance on point. I said, how long have I got? He said, well, we shoot it in 10 days. Fine, I said, I'll just brush up. By the way, I said, would it be a good idea if I bought some shoes here? Because I really want to start very soon tomorrow morning. And I don't want to waste time. So they took me off to this wonderful place, up a dark stairway, and there was this woman with scraped back hair. She came out with this three pairs of shoes in boxes. She put down a little piece of plastic on the floor, put the shoe on my foot, and she said, Livy! Waving her hands in the air to go up. So I said, I can't. So they helped me, one on either elbow, lifted me up, and the agony, I can't, put me down! I said, put me down! I thought, this is ridiculous. Anyway, we bought a lot of surgical spirit, and to cut a long story short, I did it. I learned a routine on point and went filming. Now, the bit I've left out on purpose is that I was asked by Joe in that interview whether I'd mind dancing topless. And I said, you mean without... and he said, yes, just in a tutu with the shoes. Dream sequence. It'll all be very well done, I promise you. Well, you don't say no. I said, no, that's fine, I said. So when we finally got round to shooting that particular scene, there on the laid out was my costume, this little sort of pie frill and a pair of shoes and a pair of knickers, I may add. Anyway, I got into this, put a towel around my shoulders and went into the makeup man who did my face. And eventually I stood up and he took the towel off me and I stood very still and pretended it was fine. It was okay by me. And he took a big sponge and wet it and he wiped it all around this big pancake thing and he rolled his sleeves back and he started to body paint me, as it were. And when he got to my boobs, he took his little finger and he very carefully lifted it up and did underneath and all the way around. I thought, this man has class. I know. Anyway, went downstairs and we did film. What I'd forgotten, of course, is that having learnt the routine, which was pretty agonising learning it, I'd forgotten that they had to do retake after retake after retake. And by the time we got to lunchtime, I could barely walk. Went upstairs, put my feet up on a table. My little dresser came running up and she said, she was just about to take the shoes off. I said, don't touch them. You'll never get them on again. Well, we went through the afternoon. By the evening, the blood was seeping through. I still have the shoes at home to prove it. I have little blood-stained pink shoes, but I did it. I did it. I think you can get it on video, unless it's been burnt by now. I loved it, and I must say, I didn't think it was too bad. The other film I did, I was doing two films at the same time, which is odd for someone who doesn't do films, but there you are. I was filming a film called SWALK, which a lot of people still, it still comes up quite a lot. It's a cult film, and I was playing Mark Less's mother. And at one point we had a dinner scene, and we had to eat lasagna. Well, the whole point was the kids were watching, and the lasagna had to look disgusting. You know, adults eating lasagna and talking. So we filmed this for 2 days. And the lasagna, they were providing buckets in the corners. People, you were allowed to chew and spit out because it was just, I mean, it sounds disgusting, but you've got to do that. And it was just the smell of it in the mornings. It was just, I can't tell you what it was like. He was shooting it for close, from above, the mouths, the every angle he could think of, chewing and eating and forks. Oh. The next day, I had been given 1 day off to go and play a rabbi's wife in the film Percy with Hal Bennett, which is about a penis transplant. I don't know if you remember. So that's the rabbi joke. Gone. And it was a short scene. It was a sort of the rabbi giving tea to Hal Bennett as he was trying to find who the donor was. And I had to pour tea and offer him a biscuit, which he was supposed to take. Now, he said, I'm sorry, I'm on a diet, I'm trying to lose weight, I will not eat a biscuit. Well, they said, we'll make one up for you out of what? Well, I can have boiled eggs, they're okay, but I'm not, only two takes at the most. Well, they made up this biscuit thing, egg, and we started shooting first day. Now, we'd been filming in a school, was SWALK, and it was all over the place. It was jolly, and suddenly I was in a huge studio, and it was bells and lights and shut the doors and quiet, action! Action, and I froze. I was looking at him and the biscuit, and I thought, I've been stuffing lasagna down me for days. I couldn't believe it. I just sat there. He said, action! The lines went. Couldn't think of a single line. Cut. Well, this happened 6-7 times, by which time the teapot was going, the cup was rattling. I was getting 1 or 2 words out, and I was terribly sorry. I'm sorry. And eventually they will take you for a walk. This director was walking me around like a psychiatrist. It was just dreadful. It was awful. So actor's nightmare. It is actors have nightmares about going and drying, not knowing where you are, what you're saying. Just, it's hell on earth. We finally got the scene together. I was so busy remembering the lines that it's been on television quite a couple of times. I look at myself being no acting actor. Just so delighted to get everything. And they had to glue the cup down on the saucer for me. That was my other wonderful film thing. Frost Report. I was in the Frost Report. John Cleese, two Ronnies, and me. I was the girl, the girly bit. I got it because at the time I was out of work, and again, and somebody said, I think I was waitressing or something, as one does, and somebody said they were looking for somebody to drown in petrol underneath the titles of A Square World, Michael Benteen. Just sit in the sidecar of a motorcycle and dishy blonde, big busty blonde serves the petrol man chats up, girl forgets, is chatted up and forgets to turn the petrol off. Sidecar fills up with petrol, I drown. Well, I did that and got the Frost Report from that because Jimmy Gilbert, who directed the Frost Report, saw that and they were looking for a new comedy girl, and that's when Rubberface came in. I was terribly proud of myself when we were doing it. I used to do it live. And I was taken out to dinner after the live show one evening by my agent and his boyfriend, gay agent, boyfriend, went to a restaurant and they left me. We ordered drinks. And at the time, I had all my full slap on. I had false eyelashes, had very short hair, rather like I have at the moment. And I had a shoestring dress, little black number. Very, very elegant, I thought I looked. And we'd ordered our drinks. I used to drink whiskey at the time in tumblers, and I used to smoke those long brown cigarettes, not cigar cigarettes. And they left me at the table, the drinks came, and I was sitting there feeling like a star, drinking whiskey and smoking the cigarette. And there was a table full of people over there in the corner. I knew they'd recognize me, I knew, and I was trying not to show. And they were sort of looking at me and hissing amongst themselves, and they were frightfully like that. I could hear that they were sort of talking like that. And suddenly, and I was preening a bit and trying to look sort of, I didn't care. And suddenly this voice rang out across the room and this woman said, "Well, I think it's a man." Robert Morley. Robert Morley did a play in the West End called How the Other Half Loves. It was Robert Morley. And we had a scene together near the beginning of the play, and the telephone was operative. It was a double set, and there was a telephone on either set. And it was imperative that the phones worked because the whole plot was around these phone calls. Well, I went in, and I just left my husband. That was the theory. Had a baby in a pram, left ostensibly outside, and I had a bag full of whatever it was, toys showing or whatever. And I'd go in, and we'd have to start the scene. And suddenly he said to me, "What have you got in the bag?" Because he did that. He got bored and he ad-libbed. I looked at him as if he was mad. I said, "Toys." He said, for Benji? "Yes. Show me." I said, "What, you want me to unpack the bag?" "Yes. Want to see the toys?" I sat there and, oh, that's a stupid thing for a child. That could hurt it. And what's that at the bottom? Newspaper. Because the props people had packed the bag with newspaper so that the toilet... Well, I mean, it was ridiculous, ridiculous. And he was fiddling with the phone at the time. And the bottom came off. The speaky bit of those old-fashioned phones. He had unscrewed it. And a speaker bit fell out. Now, Robert, bless him, had fingers like bananas. And he couldn't put it together again, He couldn't negotiate the thread, as they say. And I said, I was packing toys, but can I help you? I said, "No," he said, "I'll do this." And the time was getting on, the audience was getting restless. It was absolutely ridiculous. Then eventually I took it from him and screwed it up and sat down. And there I was with my bag full of toys, finally, and he was sitting there with the telephone together. And we sat and looked at each other and he said, "Well, I don't know where we are." And he... And he shouted out to the poor girl sitting in the corner with the script, "Where are we? Where do we start now?" And she gave him a line. "Oh, yes," he said, "right." And we were off. There was another occasion when he was given a new dressing gown because he'd been in the play. It had run for a couple of years, I think. And he was given a new dressing gown and he walked in, first scene, and he walked straight to the audience and said, "New dressing gown. What do you think? Like it?" Turned it around and said, and then started the play. Anyway, all comedy people should do one-person shows. That's the theory. And so I did. And I booked myself into Edinburgh Festival, and it did quite well. And it did very well, actually. Went to Istanbul with it for a one-night stand. It's quite grand. I stayed at the consulate with the consular and his wife. It was wonderful, and taken round in a big car with a flag waving in the front. And she said to me one day, "It's the Pope's birthday and they've got a mini Vatican, as they have in, I believe, in most capitals. Got a mini Vatican and they're having the Pope's birthday party." And I said, I've got nothing to wear. I've got my cabaret stuff, which is a black, slightly glittery dress, a jacket. No, that's, but it's long and it glitters. And I like big rings, so I always have a big ring. And she said, well, that's all right, you can wear that. I said, otherwise it's jeans. No, you can't wear that. What are you wearing? Well, she turned up in a little velvet skirt, ordinary, little white blouse, ordinary. And off we went in the car, me in my frock and ring, and her in her little black skirt and top. And they opened the door of the car, out we got. And I walk up to two men in long black frocks. The only difference was theirs weren't glittering. And they had those skull caps on and big rings and crosses, I thought. And they obviously didn't know what to make of me at all. I didn't know whether to curtsy or not. I mean, I just didn't know. And it was 6 o'clock-ish. So, you know, I kept thinking, oh, God, this is just too awful. Let it get dark. Let it get dark. I was the only one dressed up like a bishop or whatever it was. And it was, as people accumulated, I kind of hid amongst groups of them so that the bottom half of me wasn't going to show too much. It was awful. I was deeply embarrassed. There was a French restaurant opening in London, a big, big restaurant, and that they wanted a French cabaret, and they asked a lot of people, different people, to do whatever they do, items. And I happened to do a French chanteuse in my show who was drunk. So I thought that'd be a good one to do. Got to the venue at about 11, which is when cabaret people arrive, because you're not invited to the party. And they had a lot of celebrities there, and they were given this free dinner and drinks and things. And everybody was pretty well oiled by the time we got there. And they had bands and all sorts of noisy, huge place. Eventually they came up and said, you're on. So I get up on this tiny, tiny little podium in front of, oh, the drums and the piano and everything. So there's about an inch left in the front. My pianist gets to the piano. Now, nobody's taking a blind bit of notice now of anybody anywhere. They're all dancing and whatever they're doing. Music stops, and ladies and gentlemen, Sheila Stiefel, nothing. I mean, they couldn't hear it. So I stand there with a microphone in my hand, and I say, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Yvette. Now, I'm off on my bit. And somebody close by says, don't look now. Sheila Stiefel's drunk and she's got hold of the microphone. Thank you very much for being a lovely...